Hello, patrons, and welcome back to my zombie apocalypse work in progress after the plague. The good news is that judging by your comments at Patreon and in the Facebook listener group, The Sect, you seem to like the story, which is very heartening, I must say, so much so that I'm now considering not only finishing Hotel, but also expanding the project to include other stories in the After the Plague universe. As I've mentioned before, it was always intended to be a larger work, a collection of stories that would eventually come together. I suppose it would be, you know, like in The Walking Dead, but instead of just following the same group all the time, you would have one story that established one group, and then another story that establishes another group, and so on until I've established a number of groups, and then elements of those groups, and what they know, and what they've seen, all coming together in a not-yet-to-be-disclosed way. And then they can move forward together towards an ending. But whether that ending is just the ending of After the Plague Volume 1, or the ending of the entire thing, I suppose depends on A, how Volume 1 ends, and B, whether there's actually a demand for Volume 2. But if I were to go solely by your awesome collective response to my Patreon campaign so far, then there certainly is a demand for a Volume 2, if not a Volume 3. And of course it goes without saying, more Underwood and Flinch. And you know what? Thanks to that fantastic response so far to my Patreon campaign, all of the above is possible. Nay, is happening right now. Ha ha! Yes, yes, huzzah. Anyway, enough of all these affairs of the living. Let's get on with the affairs of the dead. If indeed dead they are. Previously then, on After the Plague Hotel, we met the cast and characters. Lee and Mandy, a charming couple driving around in a van with a couple of women captives in the back that appear to be part of Lee's own personal harem. Mandy, Lee's partner, isn't happy with the arrangement and wants to spend some quality time in bed with Lee alone, something which Lee assures her they can have just as soon as they get past the barrier of furniture, corpses, live rats and barbed wire that's blocking the entrance to the stairs in the hotel. But really, Mandy, can you trust Lee? And you may also remember Terry. He's the guy who watched Lee and Mandy's arrival from a window up on the fourth floor of the hotel where he and his cat Sasha reside. But who is Terry? And for that matter, how did all this nightmarish world of After the Plague ever come about in the first place? Well, with no further ado, patrons, let's find out in Episode 3. After the Plague, Hotel. Written and read by Mike Bennett. Part 3. Beyond the barricade, the stairs went up a short distance before they met a landing. From there, the next flight continued up to the first floor, and it was on that flight of stairs that Terry now stood listening to the commotion below, a wadded pillowcase pressed over his nose and mouth to dull the stench of decay rising up from the barricade. At the sound of the man and woman retreating back down the corridor, he turned and ran back upstairs to his room on the fourth floor. Sasha was lying curled on the bed when he entered. The cat opened her eyes and looked at his frightened face with mild interest. Terry shut the door and pressed himself against it. "They're going to try and get past the barricade. Can you believe it?" He hurried over to the window and parted the curtain just enough to be able to see the man and woman running out to their van. "No one's ever tried to breach the barricades before. They're fucking disease bombs, for God's sake. You can't go climbing on them. You'd have to be insane. Either that or completely fucking stupid. And looking at these two, Sasha, I'd say we're dealing with the latter category." The front of the van was facing him, and he watched as the idiots disappeared from view around the back of it. As he watched and waited, his mind ran over the structure of the barricade. He recalled how he, Joseph, and Mr. Campbell had constructed the stairwell barricades after they decided to stay on in the hotel. He still thought of his old deputy manager, Jim Campbell, as Mr. Campbell, despite the fact that he and Terry had found themselves on the same non-existent rung of the career ladder after the end of the world. Campbell had insisted they call him Jim, but for Terry, the habit had never taken. For too long, Jim had been Mr. Campbell, and too soon after the end, he had died. The end of the world. It had happened so fast. It had started in Wiltshire, at the road tunnel site under Stonehenge. Some people said they'd gone through an ancient druidic tomb and disturbed some long-buried disease, and that the above-ground structure of Stonehenge was in fact an elaborate grave marker. Others said that the stone circle had been built on something more significant, something that was never supposed to be disturbed, and that the tunnellers had brought a curse upon themselves, and by extension, the rest of us as well. In the news, eyewitnesses from the tunnel said that engineers had first reported a strange smell at the drill head, soon after which people had started collapsing, seemingly dropping dead as no life signs were present. But soon after being stretchered out to be transported to hospital, they'd quite suddenly returned to life, deranged, screaming and biting, tearing at people with their teeth and nails, killing them with their bare hands. And those they attacked, whether they died instantly from their wounds or later from the apparently communicable virus, also returned. Reports of cannibalism hadn't been believed at first, but then eyewitness video footage from innumerable phones started going viral on the internet. Scientists said the disease, for that's what it was now assumed to be, was spread by blood and saliva. The government appealed for calm, attempting to play it down. And while the mainstream media had tried to control what people saw in order to enforce the government's message, the internet couldn't be silenced. Social media had been ablaze with stories and images that showed a terrifying, uncontrollable wave of violence and insanity. Unable to control the flow of information, in the days before the TV news had finally gone off air, they'd shown infographics of how cases were spreading out from Wiltshire like a black stain, and how new pockets were opening up in other places around the country where bitten people had been taken for care or scientific examination. "Stay in, draw your curtains and wait for rescue," became the new and oft-repeated mantra on all channels. "Don't try to travel, as roads are blocked. Trains weren't running and air and seaports were closed because Britain was taking its responsibility to protect the international community seriously and enforcing a quarantine." Twitter told a different story. The international community had quarantined Britain, whether Britain liked it or not. All flights from the UK were cancelled at their point of destination and denied permission to land anywhere in the world, while British seaports were blockaded by the navies of other European states. Not that that stopped people trying to get out by sea. At first, people had thought the warships were bluffing when they warned the fishing boats, motorboats and even jet skis to turn back. But they'd kept going, probably thinking they'd be picked up as refugees. Quarantined, yes, but picked up, given a chance to prove they were uninfected. But true to their threats, the warships had opened fire. Several boats were sunk, and the survivors, if they were picked up by anyone, were picked up by others in the flotilla of refugee boats and brought back to the ports that were seething with people, still pouring in on roads. People that either hadn't heard or hadn't credited the news that they were on a road to nowhere but chaos. Port cities like Bristol, Liverpool, Portsmouth and Southampton were disaster areas, and when plague reached them, they went black on the map in a matter of hours. Police hadn't been able to cope. Martial law was imposed, but still cities and towns went black. Then The TV news was gone, and all that was left was the internet. Twitter became the UK news, providing information for the surviving population, but also providing the outside world's media with pictures, video, and first-hand accounts of what was happening here. That was where the word first spread about the slowdown. People started reporting how some of the infected seemed to be slowing down, and from these reports, a pattern began to emerge. After their initial return from apparent death, the infected were crazed, like rabid dogs attacking any uninfected person in sight. But then, in some cases, they were reported to be slowing down. One family reported locking an infected child in their cellar, and how, over time, its frenzied state became less and less so, entering into a calmer phase. They'd reported how the kid's screaming had slowly become a groaning. Their Twitter followers had soared into the millions, but the family's blogging had come to an end when the electricity in the part of London where they lived had gone off. Scientists, who adamantly refused to credit the idea that they were dealing with an army of walking corpses, speculated that the infected's cannibalism was a result of the virus communicating to its host that only the warm flesh of the uninfected held any nutritional value. The reason the infected didn't attack and devour each other was presumably because the disease gained no sustenance from consuming itself. If the infected victim was able to feed regularly, they maintained a high energy level. But if, as was the case with the child in the cellar, they began to starve, so their energy levels declined. That had been the accepted, though inconclusive, theory before the power had gone off and Terry's internet connection died. But he didn't need to hear what scientists in Europe and America thought. He could see the reality from the hotel windows. As the living population of the city had dwindled to practically nothing, so the food source had begun to dry up, and the infected had begun to slow down, walking around like the legendary zombies of Haiti. That's what Twitter had dubbed the slow ones. Zombies. He'd seen some that had fallen down, too, lying there, barely moving. Maybe some of them were dead, really dead. But he couldn't say, because he hadn't been outside for ages to check. One thing he did know was that they didn't die easily. It was almost like the pathogen inside them could keep them alive no matter what. He'd seen them shot, stabbed, run over, burned. Things that would kill any normal person seemed to have no effect on the infected. Their blood was said to clot incredibly fast, like the pathogen had rewired the body not to bleed. All that seemed to actually stop them was a major wound to the head. It had been 3 months since the outbreak began, and he still saw plenty of evidence of survivors. He saw helicopters in the sky and moving vehicles on the wreckage-strewn roads. He still heard gunshots, too, echoing across the rooftops. But he also saw plenty of screamers, too, the recently infected, the fast ones. Terry still held out hope that rescue would eventually come. It had to. There was too much in this country for the world to just let it go. If the infected were dying out, help would have to come. The helicopters would report it. Maybe they were from the French Air Force or the Irish or German Air Forces. Maybe they were even British. The last American news reports he'd seen on the internet had said how the UK government had descended into deep shelters under London that had been built during the Cold War to withstand a nuclear attack, and how nuclear power stations had come under massive military protection, effectively becoming fortresses against the infected, with helicopter gunships in the air and soldiers on shoot-to-kill orders to ensure that nothing interfered with the operation of the power stations. That made sense. The last thing anyone needed were places like Sellafield going into meltdown. And since there hadn't been any nuclear meltdowns, for everyone would have known about it if there had been, then clearly the power stations must still be okay. Power must still be on in the areas that they supplied, and communities of soldiers, maybe even civilian communities, were all safe and under guard. For Terry, as long as there were still helicopters in the sky, there was still something to hold out hope for. At the sound of a woman crying out in pain, Terry's eyes flashed back into focus on the van below. The man, with a coil of rope slung over his shoulder, was standing a few feet to the side of the rear of the van and grinning as he pulled on a retractable dog leash. The leash, extended to a length of about 7 or 8 feet, was taut and disappeared into the van. Terry tensed, expecting to see a Rottweiler or some other powerful breed come trotting out. Instead, he drew out a woman. The leash was fastened to a collar around her neck. With one hand she clung to the leash, and with the other she tried to keep the ends of a blanket tight around her shoulders. Terry saw that her legs and feet were naked, and a gust of wind briefly revealed that the rest of her was too. He closed his eyes and lowered his face to the back of Sasha's head. "Oh no," he murmured. He'd seen this sort of thing on the streets before, with both female and male captives enslaved by gangs. He'd kept his distance. It was none of his business, and any attempt to intervene could well have been the last thing he ever did. But now it was here, right under his nose. The woman cried out again, and he opened his eyes to see another woman emerging into view. This one was clothed and pushing at the blanketed woman when she resisted the tugging of the man. Then, following the sound of slamming doors, came the velour tracksuited woman. She had the shotgun levelled at both of the other women and walked after them as the man now led them towards the entrance of the hotel. The word "juicy" on the tracksuited woman's bottom pitched and rolled in and out of legibility as she walked. Terry's eyes went to his catapult and sack of lead fishing line weights that he'd taken from an angling shop. It was a tempting target, but he knew better than to act now. If and when the time came, he'd take the shot, and when he did, it wouldn't be her backside he'd be aiming at. Lee released the catch and fed out more leash to give his captive a little more freedom.
"Stop bawling, unless you want to bring a load of them walking pus bags on us. Maybe you'd rather be eaten alive, eh? You want me to tie you to a post out here while we go in and settle down for the night? We could watch you get torn apart from our bedroom window. Add that beef alive entertainment, eh?"
He jerked on the leash and the woman's head snapped forward.
"Is that what you want, is it?"
The woman, her mouth still covered with a strip of duct tape, shook her head and made a desperate cry that Lee interpreted as no.
"Well, come on then, and stop trying to pull away."
"You should leave her here anyway, Lee," said Mandy. "We don't need her for anything."
"Yeah, you might not, girl, but you ain't running this show, are ya?"
Mandy said nothing. She glowered at their captive companions and gave the second woman, Liz, a jab in the back with the barrels of the shotgun.
"Go on, you slag, or you'll get left out here and all."
Liz said nothing, knowing that speaking only brought more resentment upon her. She gave the blanketed woman, Camilla, a shove and kept walking behind her and Lee toward the hotel doors.
"Now," said Lee, "we've cleared the entrance and the hallway downstairs, but there's a bunch of shit we've got to clear away from the bottom of the stairs before we can get up to the safety of the upstairs rooms. Now that's where you two come in. You are going to clear it."
"What kind of shit?" asked Liz.
"We're going to need tools," Lee continued as if he hadn't heard her. "Anything we can find. Ideally a pickaxe, but I can't imagine we'll get hold of one of them in there."
"A pickaxe?" said Liz as they entered the foyer.
"Seriously, what kind of shit needs a pickaxe to move it?"
Facing forwards, Lee scowled. He was getting sick of this one. She was mouthy. Thought she actually had a say in things, when in fact she had less say than a dog. That and she was too skinny for his taste. She'd been all right at first, but
Once they'd picked up the posh tart, Camilla, he'd lost all interest in her sexually. Now she was only useful as a guard dog to keep Camilla from getting away while he and Mandy were driving in the cab of the van. But if this place worked out for them, they wouldn't need the van anymore. He could keep Camilla under lock and key in a top-floor room, and then he'd have no further need of Liz. As soon as he'd realised the barricade would have to be dismantled, he'd known that it was Liz who was going to do the heavy work. Yes, he needed tools, but she was the only tool he'd really need. He turned around and grinned at her with his plaque-encrusted teeth. "Don't worry, sweetheart. You'll find out soon enough."
The music you're listening to is by David Beard at davidbeardmusic.com.
Oh dear, oh dear, patrons. That Lee is a most unpleasant character, isn't he? He's got nothing in mind for those poor captive women other than slavery and murder. What a scumbag. Will Terry take his catapult and fire a lead fishing weight at a more compelling target than Mandy's backside? Find out in the next thrilling episode of After the Plague Hotel, only at Patreon. Now, one of the problems that we writers in the UK have when it comes to telling stories like this one is the fact that in this country guns are illegal. Unless you're a farmer or a game warden or something like that, and can get your hands on a double-barrel shotgun license. And that's why Lee, as he's someone who's roamed around a lot in his van, has got his hands on a shotgun, and why Terry, who's encamped in the hotel, has got no firearm at all. So, to arm Terry, I had to come up with something else. I thought about all the things that can fire projectiles, and I remembered when I was a kid, I used to go fishing on the River Thames. I never used to catch much, other than an abundant little fish called a gudgeon. But anyway, I used to enjoy going. It was a hobby, you know. Anyway, I remember I had a piece of kit called a bait pult. It was fantastic. It was a catapult, but it had a kind of like a rubber cup. That you could put maggots in, or bread pulp, or whatever, and, you know, you'd draw it back and pchoong, fire it out over the river to wherever you had your line. And it could also fire a pebble at about a gazillion miles an hour at an empty tin can. So, it was this that I thought of when it came to arming Terry. Something he could pick up easily in an angling shop, something that wouldn't have already been looted. And of course, with the lead fishing weights that he'd also find in an angling shop, something that would have a huge supply of ammo as well. So, if you're in the UK and you want to start arming yourself and building up your supply of equipment for the inevitable zombie holocaust that we all know is just around the corner, then go to a fishing shop and get yourself a bait pult and a supply of lead line weights. And then you're all set to go. But hopefully that zombie apocalypse will hold off for a while and give me time to write another episode of After the Plague, which will, apocalypse permitting, be in your ears in a few weeks' time. The next thing that I'll be putting up here on Patreon is Underwood and Flinch, Blood and Smoke, Episode 8. So, whatever you do, don't go away. But for me, for now, until the dead rise again into After the Plague Hotel, farewell.
This podcast has been brought to you today by you. Yes, you, and all my other sponsors at Patreon. Thank you for supporting me, and never forget that everything I produce from now on, be it on paper or on podcast, is as a result of your contribution.
I did a mini fist pump there, but obviously you couldn't see it.